Listening Library presents The Last Star by Rick Yancey. Read for you by Phoebe Stroll and Ben Yannetti.
Let no one despair, even though in the darkest night the last star of hope may disappear. Friedrich Schiller. The Girl Who Could Fly. Many years ago, when he was 10, her father had ridden a big yellow bus to the planetarium. There, the ceiling above him exploded into a million glimmering shards of light. His mouth dropped open. His small fingers clamped down on the edge of the wooden bench upon which he sat. Over his head, pinpricks of white fire spun, pure as the day the Earth emerged as a blackened, pockmarked rock. An average planet orbiting an average star at the edge of an average galaxy in a limitless universe. The Big Dipper, Orion, Ursa Major, the droning monotone of the astronomer's voice. The children's faces lifted up, open mouths, unblinking eyes, and the boy feeling infinitesimally small beneath the immensity of that artificial sky. He would not forget that day. Years later, when his daughter was very young, she would run to him, pudgy toddler legs wobbling, solid little arms lifted up, eyes burning with anticipation and joy, crying, "Daddy, Daddy!" Stubby fingers spread wide, reaching for him, reaching for the sky. And she would leap, a fearless launch into empty space, because he wasn't just her father. He was Daddy. He would catch her. He would not let her fall. Crying, "Fly, Daddy, fly!" And up she would go, rocketing toward the immensity of the unbounded sky, arms open to embrace the infinite, her head thrown back, rushing to that place where terror and wonder meet, her squeals the distilled hilarity of being weightless and free, of being safe in his arms, of being alive. Cassiopeia. From that day at the planetarium, when her life lay 15 years in the future, there was no doubt what name he would give her.
Chapter 1. I Will Sit With You. This is my body. In the cave's lowermost chamber, the priest raises the last wafer. His supply has been exhausted. Toward the formations that remind him of a dragon's mouth frozen in mid-roar, the growths like teeth glistening red and yellow in the lamplight. The catastrophe of the divine sacrifice by his hands. Take this, all of you, and eat of it. Then the chalice containing the final drops of wine. Take this, all of you, and drink from it. Midnight. In late November, in the caves below, the small band of survivors will remain warm and hidden, with enough supplies to last until spring. No one has died of the plague in months. The worst appears to be over. They are safe here, perfectly safe. With faith in your love and mercy, I eat your body and drink your blood. His whispers echo in the deep. They clamber up the slick walls, skitter along the narrow passage toward the upper chambers, where his fellow refugees have fallen into a restless sleep. Let it not bring me condemnation, but health in mind and body. There is no more bread, no more wine. This is his final communion. May the body of Christ bring me to everlasting life. The stale fragment of bread that softens on his tongue. May the blood of Christ bring me to everlasting life. The drops of soured wine that burn his throat. God in his mouth. God in his empty stomach. The priest weeps. He pours a few drops of water into the chalice. His hand shakes. He drinks the precious blood commingled with water, then wipes clean the chalice with the purificator. It is finished. The everlasting sacrifice is over. He dabs his cheeks on the same cloth he used to clean the chalice. The tears of man, and the blood of God inseparable. Nothing new in that. He wipes clean the paten with the cloth, then stuffs the purificator into the chalice and sets it aside. He pulls the green stole from his neck, folds it carefully, kisses it. He loved everything about being a priest, loved the mass most of all. His collar is damp with sweat and tears and loose about his neck. He's lost 15 pounds since the plague struck and abandoned his parish to make the 100-mile journey to the caverns north of Urbana. Along the way, he gained many followers, over 50 in all, though 32 died from the infection before reaching safety. As their deaths approached, he spoke the rite, Catholic, Protestant, or Jew. It didn't matter. May the Lord in his love and mercy help you. Tracing a cross on their hot foreheads with his thumb. May the Lord, who frees you from sin, save you. The blood that seeped from their eyes mixed with the oil he rubbed on their lids, and smoke rolled across open fields and hunkered in woods and capped over roads like ice over languid rivers in deep winter. Fires in Columbus, fires in Springfield and Dayton, in Huber Heights and London and Fairborn, in Franklin and Middletown and Xenia. In the evenings, the light from 1,000 fires turned the smoke a dusky orange, and the sky sank to an inch above their heads. The priest shuffled through the smoldering landscape with one hand outstretched, pressing a rag over his nose and mouth with the other, while tears of protest streamed down his face. Blood crusted beneath his broken nails, blood caked in the lines of his hands and in the soles of his shoes. Not much farther, he encouraged his companions. Keep moving. Along the way, someone nicknamed him Father Moses, for he was leading his people out of the obscurity of smoke and fire to the promised land of Ohio's most colorful caverns. People were there, of course, to greet them when they arrived. The priest expected it. A cave does not burn. It is impervious to weather. Best of all, it's easy to defend. After military bases and government buildings, caves were the most popular destinations in the aftermath of the arrival. Supplies had been gathered, water and non-perishables, blankets and bandages and medicines, and weapons, naturally, rifles and pistols and shotguns and many knives. The sick were quarantined in the welcome center above ground, lying in cots arranged between the display shelves of the gift shop, and every day the priest visited them, spoke with them, prayed with them, heard their confessions, delivered communion, whispered the things they wanted to hear. Per sacro sancta humane reparationis mysteria, by the sacred mysteries of man's redemption. Hundreds would die before the dying was over. They dug a pit 10 feet wide and 30 feet deep to the south of the welcome center to burn them. The fire smoldered day and night, and the smell of burning flesh had become so commonplace they hardly noticed. Now it's November, and in the lowermost chamber, the priest rises. He is not tall. Still, he must stoop to avoid smacking his head into the ceiling or against the stone teeth that bristle from the roof of the dragon's mouth. The mass is ended. Go in peace. He leaves behind the chalice and the purificator, the paten and his stole. They are relics now, artifacts from an age receding into the past at the speed of light. We began as cave dwellers, the priest thinks as he makes his way toward the surface, and to caves we have returned. Even the longest journey is a circle, and history will always cycle back to the place where it began. From the missal, remember you are dust, and unto dust you shall return. And the priest rises like a diver kicking toward the dome of the sky, sparkling above the water. Along the narrow passageway that winds gently upward between walls of weeping stone, the floor is as smooth as the lanes of a bowling alley. Only a few months before, school children on field trips marched in single file, trailing their fingers along the rock face, their eyes searching for monsters in the shadows that pooled in the crevices. They were still young enough to believe in monsters. And the priest, rising like a leviathan from the lightless sleep. The trail to the surface runs past the caveman's couch and the crystal king, into the big room, the main living area for the refugees, and finally into the palace of the gods, his favorite part of the caverns, where crystalline formations shine like frozen shards of moonlight, and the ceiling sensually undulates like waves rolling into shore. Here, close to the surface, the air thins, becomes drier, tinged with the smoke of the fires that still feed upon the world they left behind. Lord, bless these ashes by which we show that we are dust. Snatches of prayer run through his mind, fragments of song, litanies and blessings and the words of absolution. May God give you pardon and peace, and I absolve you from your sins. And from the Bible, I went down to the roots of the mountains, to the land whose bars closed behind me forever. Incense burning in the censer, soft spring sunlight shattered by stained glass, the creaking of the pews on Sunday like the hull of an ancient vessel far at sea. The stately measure of the seasons, the calendar that governed his life from the time he was an infant, Advent, Christmas, Lent, Easter. He knows he loved the wrong things, the rituals and traditions, the pomp and foppery for which outsiders faulted the church. He adored the form, not the substance, the bread, not the body. It didn't make him a bad priest. He was quiet and humble and faithful to his calling. He enjoyed helping people. These weeks in the cave had been some of the most fulfilling of his life. Suffering brings God to his natural home, the manger of terror and confusion, pain and loss, where he was born. Turn over the currency of suffering, the priest thinks, and you will see his face. A watchman sits just inside the opening above the palace of the gods, his burly frame silhouetted against the spray of stars beyond him. The sky has been scrubbed clean by a stiff north wind auguring winter. The man wears a baseball cap pulled low over his forehead and a worn leather jacket. He's holding a pair of binoculars. A rifle rests in his lap. The man nods a hello to the priest. "Where's your coat, Father? It's a cold one tonight." The priest smiles wanly. "I lent it to Agatha, I'm afraid." The man grunts his understanding. Agatha is the complainer of the group. Always cold, always hungry, always something. He lifts the binoculars to his eyes and scans the sky. "Have you seen any more of them?" the priest asks. They spotted the first grayish-silver, cigar-shaped object a week before, hanging motionlessly above the caverns for several minutes, before silently shooting straight up, dwindling to a pinprick scar in the vast blue. Another, or the same one, appeared 2 days later, gliding soundlessly over them until it dropped beneath the horizon. There was no question about the origin of these strange craft. The cave dwellers knew they weren't terrestrial. It was the mystery of their purpose that frightened them. The man lowers the binoculars and rubs his eyes. "What's the matter, Father? Can't sleep?" "Oh, I don't sleep much these days," the priest says. Then he adds, "So much to do." He doesn't want the man to think he's complaining. No atheists in foxholes. The cliche hangs in the air like a rancid smell. "Or in caves," the priest says. Since they met, he is strained to know this man better, but he is a closed room, the door securely deadbolted by anger and grief, and the hopeless dread of the doomed living on borrowed time. For months, there's been no turning from it or hiding from it. For some, death is the midwife to faith. For others, it is faith's executioner. The man pulls a pack of gum from his breast pocket, carefully unwraps a piece, and folds it into his mouth. He counts the remaining sticks before slipping the pack back into his pocket. He does not offer any to the priest. "My last pack," the man says in explanation. He shifts his weight on the cold stone. "I understand," the priest says. "Do you?" The man's jaw moves with a hypnotic rhythm as he chews. "Do you really?" The dry bread, the soured wine, the taste lingers on his tongue. The bread could have been broken. The wine could have been divided. He did not have to celebrate the mass alone. "I believe that I do," the little priest answers. "I don't," the man says slowly and deliberately. "I don't believe in a goddamn thing." The priest blushes. His soft, embarrassed laughter is like the patter of children's feet up a long staircase. He touches his collar nervously. "When the power died, I believed it would come back on, the man with the rifle says. Everybody did. The power goes out, the power comes back on. That's faith, right? He gnawed the gum, left side, right side, pushing the green knob back and forth with his tongue. Then the news trickles in from the coasts that there are no coasts anymore. Now Reno is prime oceanfront property. Big deal, so what? There have been earthquakes before, there have been tsunamis. Who needs New York? What's so special about California? We'll bounce back. We always bounce back. I believed that. The watchman is nodding, staring at the night sky, at the cold, blazing stars. Eyes high, voice low. Then people got sick. Antibiotics, quarantines, disinfectants. We put on masks and washed our hands until our skin peeled off. Most of us died anyway. And the man with the rifle watches the stars as if waiting for them to shake loose from the black and tumble to the earth. Why shouldn't they? My neighbors, my friends, my wife and kids. I knew that all of them wouldn't die. How could all of them die? Some people will get sick, but most people won't, and the rest will get better, right? That's faith. That's what we believed. The man pulls a large hunting knife from his boot and begins to clean the dirt from beneath his nails with its tip. This is faith. You grow up, you go to school, find a job, get married, start a family. Finishing the job on one hand, a nail for each rite of passage, then beginning on the other. Your kids grow up, they go to school, they find a job, they get married, they start a family. Scrape, 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 scrape. He pushes his hat back with the heel of the hand that wields the knife. I was never what you'd call a religious person. I haven't seen the inside of a church in 20 years. But I know what faith is, Father. I know what it is to believe in something. The lights go out, they come back on. The floodwaters roll in, they roll out again. Folks get sick, they get better. Life goes on. That's true faith, isn't it? Your mumbo jumbo about heaven and hell, sin and salvation. Throw it all out, and you're still left with that. Even your biggest church-bashing atheist has faith in that. Life will go on. Yes, the priest says. Life will go on. The watchman bares his teeth. He jabs the knife toward the priest's chest and snarls. You haven't heard a damn word I've said. See, this is why I can't stand your kind. You light your candles and mumble your Latin spells, and pray to a God who isn't there, doesn't care, or is just plain crazy or cruel or both. The world burns, and you praise the asshole who either said it or let it. The little priest has raised his hands, the same hands that consecrated the bread and wine, as if to show the man that they are empty, that he means no harm. I don't pretend to know the mind of God, the priest begins, lowering his hands. Eyeing the knife, he quotes from the book of Job. Therefore I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. The man stares at him for a very long, very uncomfortable moment, absolutely still except for his jaw working the already tasteless knob of gum. I'm going to be honest with you, Father, he says matter-of-factly. I feel like killing you right now. The priest nods somberly. I'm afraid that may happen when the truth hits home. He eases the knife from the man's shaking hand. The priest touches the man's shoulder. The man flinches, but doesn't pull away. What is the truth? The man whispers. This, the little priest answers, and drives the knife deep into the man's chest. The blade is very sharp. It slides through the man's shirt easily, gliding between the ribs, before sinking 3 inches into the heart. The priest pulls the man to his chest and kisses the top of his head. May God give you pardon and peace. It is over quickly. The gum drops from the man's slackened lips, and the priest picks it up and tosses it through the cave's mouth. He eases the man onto the cold stone floor and stands up. The wet knife glimmers in his hand. The blood of the new and everlasting covenant. The priest studies the dead man's face, and his heart burns with rage and revulsion. The human face is hideous, unendurably grotesque. No need to hide his disgust anymore. The little priest returns to the big room, following a well-worn path into the main chamber where the others twitch and turn in restless sleep. All except Agatha, who leans against the back wall of the chamber, a small woman lost in the fur-lined jacket the little priest had lent her, her frizz of unwashed hair a cyclone of gray and black. Grime nestles in the deep crevices of her withered face, around a mouth bereft of dentures long since lost, and eyes buried in folds of sagging skin. This is humanity, the priest thinks. This is its face.
Father, is that you?
Her voice is barely audible, a mouse's squeak, a rat's high-pitched cry. And this, humanity's voice.
Yes, Agatha, it's me.
She squints into the human mask he has worn since infancy, obscured in shadow.
I can't sleep, Father. Will you sit with me a while?
Yes, Agatha. I will sit with you. Chapter 2. He carries the remains of his victims to the surface, two at a time, one under each arm, and throws them into the pit, dropping them down without ceremony, before descending for another load. After Agatha, he killed the rest as they slept. No one woke. The priest worked quietly, quickly, with sure, steady hands, and the only noise was the whisper of cloth tearing as the blade sank home into the hearts of all 46, until his was the only heart left beating. At dawn, it begins to snow. He stands outside for a moment and lifts his face to the sky that is blank and gray. Snow settles on his pale cheeks, his last winter for a very long time. At the equinox, the pod will descend to return him to the mothership, where he'll wait out the final cleansing of the human infestation by the ones they have trained for the task. Once on board the vessel, from the serenity of the void, he will watch as they launch the bombs that will obliterate every city on Earth, wiping clean the vestiges of human civilization. The apocalypse dreamed of by humankind since the dawn of its consciousness will finally be delivered, not by an angry god, but indifferently, as cold as the little priest when he plunged the knife into his victims' hearts. The snow melts on his upturned face. 4 months until winter's end. 120 days until the bombs fall. Then, the unleashing of the fifth wave. The human pawns they have conditioned to kill their own kind. Until then, the priest will remain, to slaughter any survivors who wander into his territory. Almost over. Almost there. The little priest descends into the palace of the gods and breaks his fast.
Chapter 3. Ringer. Beside me, Razor whispered, "Run." His sidearm exploded beside my ear. His target was the smallest thing that is the sum of all things. His bullet, the sword that severed the chain that bound me to her. Teacup. As Razor died, he lifted his soft, soulful eyes to mine and whispered, "You're free. Run." I ran. Chapter 4. I smashed through the watchtower window, the ground rushing up to meet me. When I land on the tarmac, not a single bone will break. I will feel no pain. I have been enhanced by the enemy to withstand greater falls than this. My last fall began at 5,000 feet. This one is cake. I land, roll to my feet, and sprint around the tower, then down the runway toward the concrete barrier and the fence topped in razor wire. The wind screams in my ears. I am faster now than the fastest animal on Earth. The cheetah is a tortoise compared to me. The sentries on the perimeter must see me and the man in the watchtower too, but no shots are fired. No order is given to take me down. I barrel toward the end of the runway like a bullet singing down the muzzle of a gun. They can't catch you. How can they ever catch you? The processor embedded in my brain made the calculations before I even hit the ground, and has already relayed the information to the thousands of microscopic drones assigned to my muscular system. I don't have to think about speed or timing or point of attack. The hub does it for me. End of the runway, I leap. The ball of my foot lands on top of the concrete barrier for an instant, then pushes off to launch me toward the fence. The razor wire rushes toward my face. My fingers slip into the 2-inch-wide gap between the coils and the top bar to execute a backward roll over the top. I fly over it feet first, back arched, arms outstretched. I stick the landing and accelerate again to full speed, covering the 100 yards of open ground between the fence and the woods in less than 4 seconds. No bullets chase me. No chopper revs to life to follow me. The trees close behind me like a curtain being drawn, and my footing is sure on the slick, uneven ground. I reach the river, its water swift and black. My feet seem to barely break the surface as I cross. On the other side, the woods give way to open tundra, unmarred miles stretching toward the northern horizon, a boundless wilderness in which I'll be lost, undetected, unmolested, free. I run for hours. The 12th system sustains me. It reinforces my joints and bones. It bolsters my muscles, gives me strength, endurance, nullifies my pain. All I have to do is surrender. All I have to do is trust, and I will endure. VQP. By the light of 100 bodies burning, Razor carved those 3 letters into his arm. VQP. He conquers who endures. Some things, he told me the night before he died, down to the smallest of things, are worth the sum of all things. Razor understood that I would never leave Teacup to suffer while I escaped. I should have known he was going to save me by betraying me. He'd been doing it from the beginning. He killed Teacup so I could live. The featureless landscape extends in every direction. The sun falls toward the edge of the cloudless sky. In the bitter wind biting my face, my tears freeze as they fall. The 12th system can protect you from the pain that afflicts your body, but it's helpless against the pain that crushes your soul. Hours later, I'm still running as the last light leeches from the sky and the first stars appear. And there is the mothership hovering on the horizon, like a lidless green eye staring down. No running from it, no hiding. It is unreachable, unassailable. Long after the last human being crumbles to a handful of dust, it will be there, implacable, impenetrable, unknowable. God has been dethroned. And I run on, through a primordial landscape unscarred by any human thing, the world as it was before trust and cooperation unleashed the beast of progress. The world is circling back now to what it was before we knew it. Paradise lost. Paradise returned. I remember Vosh's smile, sad and bitter. A savior. Is that what I am? Running toward nothing, running away from nothing, running across an empty landscape of flawless white beneath the immensity of the indifferent sky, I see it now. I think I understand. Reduce the human population to a sustainable number, then crush the humanity out of it, since trust and cooperation are the real threats to the delicate balance of nature, the unacceptable sins that drove the world to the edge of a cliff. The others concluded that the only way to save the world was to annihilate civilization. Not from without, but from within. The only way to annihilate human civilization was to change human nature. Chapter 5. I continued running into the wilderness. There was still no pursuit. As the days passed, I worried less about choppers swooping in and strike teams dropping down, and more about staying warm and finding the fresh water and protein I needed to sustain the fragile host of the 12th system. I dug holes to hide in, built lean-tos to sleep under. I honed tree branches into spears and hunted rabbit and moose and ate their meat raw. I didn't dare make a fire, even though I knew how. At Camp Haven, the enemy had taught me. The enemy had taught me everything I needed to know about survival in the wilderness, then gave me alien technology that helped my body adapt to it. He taught me how to kill and how to avoid being killed. He taught me what human beings had forgotten after 10 centuries of cooperation and trust. He taught me about fear. Life is a circle bound by fear. The fear of the predator. The fear of the prey. Without fear, life would not exist. I tried to explain that to Zombie once, but I don't think he understood. I lasted 40 days in the wilderness. And no, the symbolism wasn't lost on me. I could have lasted longer. The 12th system would have sustained me well past 100 years. Queen Marika, the lone ancient huntress, a soulless husk gnawing on the dried bones of dead animals, uncontested sovereign of a meaningless domain, until the system finally collapsed and her body fell apart or was devoured by scavengers, her bones scattered like unread runes in an abandoned landscape. I went back. By that point, I realized why they weren't coming. Vosh was 2 moves ahead of me. He always had been. Teacup was dead now, but I was still bound to a promise I never made to a person who was probably dead too. But probability had become meaningless. He knew I couldn't abandon Zombie, not when there was a chance I could save him. And there was only one way to save him. Vosh knew that too. I had to kill Evan Walker. 1. The first day. Chapter 6. Cassie. I'm going to kill Evan Walker. The brooding, enigmatic, self-involved, secretive bastard. I'm going to put his poor, tortured, human-alien hybrid soul out of its misery. You're the mayfly. You're the thing worth dying for. I woke up when I saw myself in you. Oh, puke. Last night I gave Sam's a bath, the first in 3 weeks, and he damn near broke my nose, or I should say rebroke my nose, since Evan's old girlfriend, or friend with benefits, or whatever she was, broke it first by slamming my face into a door behind which was my little brother, the little shit I was trying to save, and the same little shit who nearly broke it again. See the irony there? There's probably some symbolism, too, but it's late and I haven't slept in, like, 3 days, so forget it. Back to Evan and the reason I'm going to kill him. Basically, it boils down to the alphabet. After Sam hit me on the nose, I burst out of the bathroom, soaking wet, whereupon I smacked into Ben Parrish's chest. Ben was lurking in the hallway as if every little thing that has to do with Sam is his responsibility, the aforesaid little shit screaming obscenities at my back, the only dry part of my body after trying to wash his, and Ben Parrish, the living reminder of my father's favorite saying that it's better to be lucky than smart, gave me that ridiculous, "What's up?" look. So stupidly cute that I was tempted to break his nose, thereby making him not so damn Ben Parrish-y looking. "You should be dead," I said to him. "I know I just wrote that I was going to kill Evan, but you need to understand." Oh, screw it. No one is ever going to read this. By the time I'm gone, there won't be anyone who can read. So this isn't being written for you, future reader who won't exist. It's for me. "Probably," Ben said. "What are the odds that someone I knew from before would still be here now?" He thought about it, or pretended to think about it. He's a guy. "About 7 billion to 1? "I think that would be 7 billion to 2, Ben," I said. "Or 3.5 billion to 1. "Wow, that much?" He jerked his head toward the bathroom door. "What's up with Nugget?"
"Sam. His name is Sam. Call him Nugget again, and I'll knee you in yours."
He smiled. Then he either pretended to get what I said a beat later, or he immediately understood what I said, but anyway, the smile morphed into a tight-lipped look of wounded pride. "They're slightly larger than Nugget's. Slightly." Then, click, The smile flashed back on. Want me to talk to him? I told him I didn't give a shit what he did. I had better things to do, like killing Evan Walker. I stormed down the hallway into the living room, still close enough or not far enough away to hear Sam yell, I don't care, zombie! I don't care! I don't care! I hate her! Past Dumbo and Megan sitting on the sofa working on a jigsaw puzzle somebody found in the kids' room, a scene from a Disney cartoon or something, and their eyes cut away as I barreled past, like, don't mind us, we won't stop you, you're good, nobody saw nothing. Outside on the porch, it's cold as hell because spring refuses to come. Spring is never coming because extinction events piss it off. Or the others have engineered another ice age just because they can, because why settle for doomed humans when you can have cold, starving, and miserable doomed humans? So much more satisfying that way. He was leaning on the railing to take the weight off his bad ankle, the rifle nestled in the crook of his arm, wearing his uniform of a wrinkled plaid shirt and skinny jeans. His face lit up when he saw me banging open the screen door. His eyes drank me in. Oh, the Evanness of it all. How he gulps down my presence like a guy stumbling upon an oasis in the desert. I slapped him. Why did you just hit me? He asked, after racking 10,000 years worth of alien wisdom for the answer. Do you know why I'm wet? I asked. He shook his head. Why are you wet? I was giving my baby brother a bath. Why was I giving him a bath? Because he was dirty? For the same reason I spent a week cleaning up this dump after we moved in. She may have been a supercharged, technologically enhanced alien-human hybrid with the looks of a Norwegian ice princess and the heart to match, but Grace was a terrible housekeeper. Dust piled in every corner like snowdrifts, mold growing on top of mold, a kitchen that would make a hoarder blush. Because that's what human beings do, Evan. We don't live in filth. We bathe. We wash our hair, and we brush our teeth, and we shave off unwanted hair. Sam needs to shave? Trying to be funny. Dumb idea. Shut up! I'm talking. When I talk, you don't talk. When you talk, I don't talk. That's another thing humans do. They treat each other with respect. Respect, Evan. He nodded somberly. Respect, he echoed, which made me even angrier. He was handling me. It's all about respect. Being clean and not stinking like a pig is about respect. Pigs don't stink. Shut up. Well, I grew up on a farm, that's all. I shook my head. Oh no, that isn't all. That isn't half of all. The part of you I slapped didn't grow up on any goddamned farm. He left his rifle leaning against the railing and limped over to the swing. He sat. He gazed off into the middle distance. It isn't my fault Sam needed a bath. Of course it's your fault. All of this is your fault. He looked at me, and his tone was controlled. Cassie, I think you should go back inside now. What, before you lose your temper? Oh, please lose it for once. I would love to see what that looks like. You're cold. No, I'm not. As I realized how badly I was shaking, standing in front of him in my wet clothes, icy water dripped down the back of my neck and traced a path down my spine. I folded my arms over my chest and willed my freshly brushed, very clean, teeth to stop chattering. Sam's forgotten his ABCs, I informed him. He stared at me for a long 4 seconds. I'm sorry, what? His ABCs? You know, the alphabet, you intergalactic swineherd. Well, his eyes wandered from my face to the empty road across from the empty yard that stretched toward empty horizons, over which there were more empty roads and woods and fields and towns and cities, the world one big hollowed-out gourd, a slop bucket of emptiness. Emptied by things like him. The whatever he was before he inserted himself into a human body like a hand up a puppet's ass. He leaned forward and shrugged out of his jacket, the same stupid bowling jacket he showed up in at the old hotel. The Urbana Pinheads, and held it out,
please. Maybe I shouldn't have taken it. I mean, the pattern kept repeating itself. I'm cold, he warms me. I'm hurt, he heals me. I'm hungry, he feeds me. I'm down, he picks me up. I'm like the hole at the beach that keeps filling up with water. I'm not a big person. The jacket engulfed me. And the warmth from his body, that too. It steadied me. Not necessarily the fact that the warmth came from his body, just the warmth itself. Another thing human beings do is learn their alphabets, I said, so they can read, so they can learn things. Things like history and math and science and practically everything else you can name, including the really important things like art and culture and faith and why things happen and why other things don't and why anything even exists in the first place. My voice broke. Uninvited, there's that image again of my father pulling a red wagon loaded with books after the third wave and his lecture about preserving knowledge and rebuilding civilization once that pesky little alien problem was disposed of. God, how sad. How pitiful. A balding, bent-shouldered man shuffling down deserted streets with a wagon load of scavenged library books behind him. While others looted canned goods and weapons and hardware to fortify their homes against marauders, my father decided the wisest course of action was to hoard reading material. He can learn them again, Evan tried. You can teach him. It took everything in me not to give him another smack. There was a time when I thought I was the last living person on Earth, which made me all of humanity. Evan isn't the only one who owes an unpayable debt. I'm humanity. He's them. And after what they've done to us, humanity should break every bone in their bodies. That's not the point, I told him. The point is, I don't understand why you did it this way. You could have killed us all without being so goddamn cruel about it. You know what I found out tonight, besides the fact that my little brother hates my guts? It's not just the ABCs he's forgotten. He doesn't remember what our mom looked like. He doesn't remember his own mother's face. Then I lost it. I wrapped myself tight in that stupid pinhead jacket and bawled, because I didn't care anymore if Evan saw me lose it. Because if anyone should have seen, it's him, the sniper murdering from a distance, comfy in his farmhouse while, 200 miles over his head, the mothership unleashed three escalating waves of devastation. 500,000 in the first attack, millions in the second, billions in the third. And while the world burned, Evan Walker was smoking deer brisket and taking leisurely walks in the woods and lounging by a cozy fire, buffing his perfect nails. He should see the face of human suffering up close. Too long he's been like the mothership, hovering above the horror, untouchable and remote. He needs to see it, touch it, press it against his perfectly shaped, wholly unbroken nose and smell it. The way Sammy has. I felt like running inside and yanking him out of the tub and dragging him naked onto the porch, where Evan Walker could count his bony ribs and feel his tiny wrists and trace the hollowed-out temples and examine the scars and sores of the little boy he's tortured, the child whose mind he's emptied of memories and whose heart he's filled with hate and hopelessness and useless rage. Evan started to stand, to pull me into his arms, no doubt, to stroke my hair and dry my tears and murmur that everything was going to be all right, because that's his M.O., but then he thought better of it. He sat back down. I told you, Cassie, he said softly. I didn't want it to happen this way. I fought against it. Until you went along with it. Still working to get a grip. Along came out a three-syllable word. And what do you mean you didn't want it to happen this way? He shifted his weight. The swing creaked. His eyes strayed back to the empty road. We could have lived among you indefinitely. Hidden, undetectable. We could have inserted ourselves into leading roles in your society. We could have shared our knowledge, exponentially expanding your potential, speeding your evolution. it's conceivable we could have given you the one thing you've always wanted and never had. What? I snuffled the snot back into my nose. I didn't have a tissue and didn't even care that it was gross. The arrival had altered the whole definition of gross. Peace, he answered. Could have. Could have. He nodded. When that option was rejected, I argued for something quicker. Quicker? An asteroid. You didn't have the technology to stop it or the time even if you did. It was a simple solution, but it wasn't a clean one. The world wouldn't have been habitable for 1,000 years. And that matters because why? You're pure consciousness, immortal like gods. What's 1,000 years to you? Apparently that question had a very complicated answer, or one he didn't want to share with me. Then he said, for 10,000 years, we had the thing that you only dreamed of for 10,000 years. He gave a short, humorless laugh. An existence without pain, without hunger, without any physical needs at all. But immortality has a price. Without bodies, we lost the things that come with them. Things like autonomy and benevolence, compassion. He opened his hands as if to show me they were empty. Sam isn't the only one who's forgotten his ABCs. I hate you, I said. He shook his head. No, you don't. I want to hate you. I hope you fail. Don't lie to yourself, Evan. You don't love me. You love the idea of me. You've messed it all up in your head. You love what I represent. He cocked his head, and his brown eyes were sparkling brighter than the stars. What do you represent, Cassie? What you thought you lost. What you thought you could never have. I'm not that. I'm just me. And what are you? I knew what he meant. And of course, I had no clue what he meant. This was it. The thing between us. The thing neither of us could put our fingers on. The unbreakable bond between love and fear. Evan's the love. I am the fear. Chapter 7. Ben was waiting to pounce the minute I went back inside. I knew he was waiting to pounce because the minute I went back inside, he pounced. Everything okay? He asked. I scrubbed the tears from my cheeks and laughed. Sure, Parrish, aside from this whole annoying alien apocalypse thing, everything's great. The more he explains, the less I understand, I said. I told you something's not right with that dude, he said, being very careful not to say, I told you so. Okay, not really. He was basically saying it. What would you do if you didn't have a body for 10,000 years, and then all of a sudden you did? I asked. He cocked his head and fought back a smile. Probably go to the bathroom. Dumbo and Megan had cleared out. We were alone. Ben was standing by the fireplace and golden light danced over his face, which had filled out some in the 6 weeks we had been holed up in Grace's safe house. Plenty of rest, food, fresh water, and antibiotics, and Ben was almost back himself. He'd never get all the way back. There was still a haunted look in his eyes, a wariness to him, like a rabbit in a hawk-patrolled meadow. He wasn't the only one. After we reached the safe house, it took 2 weeks for me to work up the courage to look in the mirror. The experience was like running into someone you hadn't seen since middle school. You recognize them, but what you really notice is the ways they've changed. They don't match your memory of how they should look, and for a second you're thrown off, because your memory of them is them. So when I looked in the mirror, I saw a self that didn't match the memory of myself, particularly the nose, which now veered slightly to the right, thanks to Grace. But I've let that go. There's no hard feelings. My nose may be crooked now, but hers has been vaporized, along with the rest of her. How's Sam? I asked. Ben jerked his head toward the back of the house. Hanging with Megan and Dumbo. He's okay. He hates my guts.
He doesn't hate your guts.
He told me he hates my guts.
Kids say things they don't mean.
Not just kids. He nodded.
He looked over my shoulder toward the front door.
Ringer was right, Cassie. This doesn't make a lot of sense.
He kidnaps a human body so he can murder all the unkidnapped human bodies. Then one day he decides he'd rather murder his own kind so he can save all the unkidnapped human bodies. And not just murder one or two of his kind here or there, all of them. He wants to destroy his entire civilization, and for what? For a girl. A girl.
Wrong thing to say. He knew it, too. But just in case there was any question, I said very slowly, "You know, Parrish, it may be a little more complicated than that. There is a human part of him, too." "Oh, Jesus, Cass, what's the matter with you? One minute you're furious at him, the next you're defending him."
His expression hardened. "I'm not worried about the human part. I know you weren't crazy about her, but Ringer's pretty damn smart, and she made a good point. If they don't need bodies, they don't need a planet. And if they don't need a planet, why did they come for ours?"
"I don't know," I snapped. "Why didn't you ask Ringer, since she's so damn smart?"
He took a breath, and then he said, "I'm going to." It took a second for me to understand what he meant. Then another to get that he was serious. A third second to do something about the first 2 seconds, which was to sit down.
"I've thought a lot about this," he began.
Then he stopped. Like he had to mince words, with me of all people. Like I had a temper or something.
"And I think I know what you're going to say, but before you say it, you need to hear me out. Just hear me out, okay? If Walker's telling the truth, we've got 4 days until the pod arrives and he leaves to do his thing. That's more than enough time for me to get there and back."
"To get where and back, Ben?"
"I won't go alone. I'll take Dumbo with me."
"Okay, with you where?"
Then I got it.
"The caverns."
He nodded quickly, relieved that I understood. "It's killing me, Cassie. I can't stop thinking about them. Maybe Cup caught up with Ringer and, well, maybe she didn't. She might be dead. Ringer might be dead. Oh, hell, they probably are dead. Or maybe they're not. Maybe they made it to the caverns and Ringer came back to the hotel to get us, only there was no us there to get because there was no there to come back to. Anyway, alive or dead, they're out there. And if they're alive, they have no clue what's coming. They'll die unless someone goes back for them."
He took a huge, shuddering breath, the first since he blasted off the verbal launching pad.
"Go back for them," I said. "Like you went back for Sam. Like you didn't go back for..."
"Yes. No. Oh, shit." His face was red, and it wasn't from standing too close to the fire. He knew what I was saying.
"This has nothing to do with my sister."
"You ran away, and you've been trying to go back ever since." He stepped toward me. Away from the firelight, his face plunged into shadow.
"You don't know a damn thing. I know that really bothers you because Cassie Sullivan knows everything, right?
What do you want from me, Ben? I'm not your mother or commanding officer or whatever. Do what you want."
I stood up. Then I sat back down. There was nowhere to go. Well, I could go to the kitchen and make a sandwich, except there was no bread or deli meat or cheese. I don't know the particulars, but I'm pretty sure there's a Subway on every corner in heaven. Also Godiva stores. On our second day here, I found Grace's stash of 46 boxes of Godiva chocolates. Not that I counted them.
"I'm having a bad day," I told him.
"My little brother hated me. My human alien personal security guard confessed he doesn't know compassion from compost. And now my old high school crush informs me he's embarking on a suicide mission to rescue 2 missing and probably dead people. Plus, I wanted a sandwich that I could never have. Since the arrival, I've been beset by more cravings than a woman pregnant with triplets, and always for things I'll never taste again. Chocolate ice cream cones, frozen pizza, whipped cream in a can, those cinnamon rolls Mom made every Saturday morning, McDonald's French fries, bacon. No, bacon was still a possibility. I would just have to find a hog, slaughter it, butcher it, cure the meat, then fry it up. Thinking about the bacon,
the potential of bacon gives me hope. Not all is lost if bacon isn't. Seriously.
I'm sorry, Ben said. I shouldn't have gone off like that.
He came over and sat down about 2 inches too close. I used to fantasize about Ben Parrish sitting with me on the sofa at my house while we shared a blanket and watched old horror movies until 1 a.m., holding a big bowl of popcorn in his lap. It was a Saturday night, and he was missing about 6 killer parties populated by people way cooler than me, but he wouldn't be anywhere else. The pleasure of my company was enough. Now here he was, only there were no killer parties, no TV, no blanket, and no damn popcorn. The world used to contain 2 Bens, the real Ben, who didn't know I existed, and the imaginary Ben, who fed me popcorn with buttery fingers. Now there were 3. The first 2 and the one who was sitting 2 inches too close, wearing a tight black sweater and sporting stubble that made him look like an indie rocker taking a break in the green room between sets. That's a lot of Bens to hold in your head at once. I should have given them different names to keep them straight. Ben, has been, and what might have been. I get it, I said. But why do you have to go now? Why can't you wait? If Evan can pull this off... He was shaking his head.
Whether or not he pulls it off won't make a difference. The danger isn't the aliens up there. The danger is the humans down here. I need to find Ringer and Cup before the 5th wave does.
He pulled my hand into his, and a little voice rose up from deep inside. Ben. That little voice belonged to the frizzy-haired middle schooler who refused to die. The freckly-nosed, introverted know-it-all, self-conscious and awkward despite dance lessons and karate lessons and pep talks from her parents, toting around a bulging bag of secrets. The silly, mundane, melodramatic secrets of adolescence that would shock the popular pretty kids, if only they knew. What was up with her? Why wouldn't she just go away already? Not only was I carrying around too many Bens, there were also too many Cassies. 3 Bens, 2 Cassies, a couple of Sams, and, of course, the literal duality of Evan Walker. Nobody was integrated anymore. Our true selves shimmered like a desert mirage, forever receding into the distance. Ben touched my face, fingertips brushing my cheek, feather light. And that little voice in my head, that fading cry, Ben. Then my voice, you're going to die.
You bet I am, he said with a smile. And it's gonna happen the way it should. Not their way, my way.
The front door creaked on its rusty hinges and a voice said,
She's right, Ben. You should wait.
Ben pulled away from me. Evan was leaning in the doorway.
Nobody asked you, Ben said. The ship is central to the next phase,
Evan said slowly and distinctly. Like he was talking to a crazy person or a moron.
Blowing it up is the only way we can end this. I don't care what you blow up, Ben said.
He turned away like he couldn't stand to look at Evan.
I don't even give a shit about ending it. Maybe it's hard for somebody with a savior complex to understand, but I don't want to save the world. Just 2 people.
He stood up, stepped over my legs, and walked toward the hallway. Evan called after him. And what he said stopped Ben cold.
The spring equinox is in 4 days. If I don't get to that ship and blow it up, every city on Earth will be destroyed.
Holy shit. I looked at Ben, he looked back at me, and then we both looked at Evan.
When you say destroyed, I started.
Blown up, Evan said.
It's the last step before the launch of the 5th wave.
Ben was slowly shaking his head at him, horrified, disgusted, enraged.
Why?
To make it easier to finish the cleansing, and to wipe out anything human that remains.
But why now? Ben asked.
The silencers will be back on board the ship. It's safe. For us, I mean. Safe for us. I looked away. I was going to be sick. I should know better by now. Just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, it gets worse.
Chapter 8. Zombie. I motion Dumbo out of the room. Let Sullivan say what she wants. He'll always be Nugget to me. The kid starts to follow me and Dumbo into the hall, and I order him to fall back. I close the door and turn to Dumbo. Grab your gear, we're moving out. Dumbo's eyes go wide. When? Right now. He swallows hard and glances down the hallway toward the family room. Just me and you, Sarge? I know what he's worried about. I'm good, Bo. Touching the spot where Ringer placed the bullet. Not 100%, more like 86.5, but good enough. Pain knifes into my side when I reached up to pull my rucksack from the closet shelf. Okay, take off a point and a half, make it 85. Still closer to 100, than to zero. Anyway, who's 100% this late in the game? Even the good evil alien broke his ankle. I rummage through the sack, though there's not a hell of a lot to rummage through. I'll need to grab some fresh water and rations from the kitchen, and a knife might come in handy. I dig into the outer pocket. Empty. What the hell? I know I put it there. What happened to it? I'm kneeling on the bedroom floor, tearing through my stuff for the third time, when Dumbo comes in. Sarge? It was here. It was right here. I look up at him and something about my expression makes him flinch. Somebody must have taken it. Jesus Christ, who the hell would have taken it, Dumbo? Taken what? I rock back onto my heels and pat my pockets. Shit.